I can't know, but I can imagine that Dorothea Dix, as she fastened her shoes one brisk morning in 1841, that her fingers trembled. Now, normally, I suspect they were steady. After all, this was a child abuse survivor who, after embracing Unitarianism with its emphasis on social responsibility, had begun running one of the first free schools for poor children in this nation. But I suspect that accomplishment didn't stop her from trembling as the carriage stopped that morning in front of the East Cambridge prison. Why bother teaching criminals? The townspeople had said. The townspeople might as well have said, it's not my problem. Now, though, as her footsteps echoed through the bleak prison hallways, she wondered if she'd made a mistake. She shivered and said, is it always so cold in here? The warden didn't answer, and turning the corner, they passed by cell after cell where people were crammed together in filth and darkness. How do you divide them up? Asked Dorothea, noticing a child almost lost amongst the legs of the adult inhabitants of the cell. The warden shrugged. We don't. Outrage flooded Dorothea's body. Children, the mentally ill, and the intellectually disabled were all packed indiscriminately in cells with violent criminals. Now, all Dorothea had to do was use her senses to gauge how deplorable the conditions were, conditions that left people feeling unwanted and without hope. But looking into her story got me thinking about how sometimes those conditions can be less obvious but equally insidious, especially at this moment, in light of the indicators we've been seeing for the future of this country. Before coming to congregational ministry, I worked at a nonprofit organization that both tested people for the HIV virus and counseled them. And in light of this week having World AIDS Day in it, I thought that it seemed like a fitting time to talk about that experience. And that counseling that I did recognized that oppressive social factors such as homophobia, racism, misogyny, poverty, and violence affect vulnerability to HIV, seen by the fact that HIV transmission has historically been centered in marginalized communities. So in that role as counselor, I was helping people create attainable steps to reduce their risk for catching HIV. Now, our clinic was free, it was anonymous, and that meant that lots of people who were facing a moment of crisis came our way. Male, female, old, young, rich, poor, they all came. Their anxiety levels were understandably high, and you could often cut the tension in that room with a knife. And for the first week, I navigated that tension and was always rewarded by our shared exhale when we discovered the test had come back as HIV negative. And then one day, that changed. Now, nothing had quite prepared me for seeing that red line on the testing stick telling me that the 25-year-old dark-haired man who sat a few feet behind me was indeed HIV positive. Now, I'll confess to you, this had been a difficult counseling session. This man had told me in halting English that he had a wife at home, but I also knew he was part of an ethnic culture where anything other than heterosexuality was deeply frowned upon. And my instinct told me that as an immigrant, as a person of color in our country, he didn't necessarily feel comfortable sharing the truth of his experience with me. I could sense all those layers of oppression pressing down upon him and how the resulting loneliness might have put him in situations or even driven him out to act in ways that put him at risk. And he would be the first person to whom I would be saying the words, your test came back HIV positive. This was tough stuff. And it was tough stuff for Dorothea Dix after visiting that prison. That night she tossed and turned in her bed, the faces of the lost and lonely haunting her dreams. And by morning she had determined what would become her life's mission. I wish my one night of sleep would do this, but it doesn't always do that, right? But she woke in the morning and she knew that she was called to improve the condition of those who had been discarded by society, particularly those suffering from disabilities and mental illness. And she started by securing a court order that ensured heat and improved living conditions in that very prison that she had visited. And this, folks, this was only the beginning. I suspect her fingers didn't tremble anymore as she buttoned her shoes on subsequent visits to prisons. Tongues wagged about the woman who had the audacity to travel alone, but still she set out purposefully to visit prison after prison, climbing down dark stone stairways to find mentally ill people chained in cellars, suffering from malnutrition and poor ventilation. And even after countless visits to collect data, she would sometimes still have to stumble outside to catch her breath. In some small way, I can relate to that experience. Being an HIV counselor meant there were times I could hardly handle what I witnessed. A child whose uncle might have accidentally infected her, the religious leader who was cheating on his blissfully unaware spouse, the young male client who left the section on his questionnaire blank that asked for the number of sexual partners in the past year. "I don't even know how to begin to count," he confessed. We talked about why most of those interactions had not been safe ones. "Ever since I moved from my family," he said, "I've just been trying to meet people, connect with people." Quietly, he added, "I know I've got it." I was sure he would have it too. And I had to force myself to view the results, but there wasn't even a ghost of a red line, HIV negative. I told him the good news, tears formed in his eyes, and as we talked, I realized there was nobody in his life that he could call a friend. And I thought back to the other people I had counseled. That woman of color who had angrily told me that she didn't need counseling, but then talked nonstop about the isolation she felt in her life. The low-income senior haunted by the fear of having caught something from the last close human connection he'd had years before. The young woman from an abusive household who'd contracted the disease before she was a legal adult. Loneliness, sometimes you could almost drink it in through your pores. It was so palpable in that counseling room. And I don't think there's anyone in this sanctuary who hasn't felt that feeling of loneliness sometimes. Me too. And I know some of us feel that right now. But I think we can see how sometimes that feeling can lead to behavior that doesn't necessarily mean we prioritize our own health. After hours, I sat on the worn upholstery of the lobby chairs next to the director of the testing facility, a man whose every word reflected the wisdom of his decades of doing this work. His name was Martin Salas, and I just heard he passed away this week. Ironically, I'd already written this about him, but I won't ever forget my conversations with him. That one evening, he waved toward the window and said, "I can gauge what is going on out there, out in the world, by what happens in here. People are disconnected from society and each other. Some come here after the loneliness becomes too much and they've acted out without thinking about their safety." I nodded. "I once saw Mother Teresa say something about loneliness being the world's biggest problem," he added. "I didn't get it then, but now, after doing this for so long, I understand. Loneliness is an epidemic." When I got home that night, I looked up that Mother Teresa quote. What she said was, "Sometimes we think that poverty is only being hungry, naked, and homeless. The poverty of being unwanted, unloved, and uncared for, that is the greatest poverty." And this is from the woman who faced, I don't know what, leprosy, famine, anything you can think of. Our own Unitarian Dorothea Dix understood that too. "I come as the advocate of forgotten men and women," she said. "The desolate, the outcast." She spent her life battling to improve the conditions of prisons and mental hospitals, emphasizing holistic treatment that would enable the disabled to have meaningful lives. She became the superintendent of U.S. Army nurses during the Civil War, and eventually after the war, Dorothea helped forgotten soldiers secure their pensions. For despite witnessing the effects of violence, disease, and neglect, Dorothea Dix, like Mother Teresa, ultimately believed that there was a great underlying suffering, the loneliness of the outcast. At the HIV testing center, we saw the causes of that loneliness, whether it's gender, age, education, sexual orientation, or race. And loneliness is an accessible word to talk about what's really going on here. It's a symptom of a greater problem, systematic oppression. We can think of oppression as societal norms that restrict and reduce the options for certain groups of people. There's a theorist named Iris Marion Young. She has defined what she calls five faces of oppression. Exploitation, which refers to the disparity between the have and have-nots. Marginalization, which marks a whole group of people as being of lower social standing, often because of race. Powerlessness, which is particularly dangerous because people feel unable to better their circumstances. They just have to accept their lot. The culture of imperialism, which means that if you don't fit into what's considered the norm, you're invisible, essentially. And finally, the face of oppression that she calls violence, which is still alive and well, as we've seen in our world over and over recently. I know that's a lot to take in, but the reason I share it with you is to answer a question that I know many think of in relation to something like HIV or other health concerns. Why don't people simply take the action they need to protect themselves? My answer is, in a world where multiple forces of oppression shape people's lives, where the threat of those forces grows greater as we look to the new leadership for this country, it's important to remember that what others might take for granted as an easy choice, what we might take for granted as an easy choice or an available option, might be a very different experience for someone else. Take that first young man who I tested as HIV positive, who was dealing with being marginalized in a culture of imperialism. He had bruises on his neck and arms that suggested violence, of which his own sense of powerlessness did not allow him to speak. Despite his outward stoicism, inside, I suspect he felt much as the young woman who freely cried as she sat before me and waited for her results. Why didn't anybody ever tell me how important it was that I protect myself? She left smiling that day, feeling that others did care, and that in turn made her feel it was worthwhile caring about herself. But sometimes her question still echoes in my head. And so when I think back to my time as an HIV counselor, sitting across from a client, whether it was the recovering heroin addict who relapsed because the drugs relieved the loneliness, or the young woman who felt so afraid of being alone she couldn't say no when her partner didn't want to use protection, I remember now how important on this very personal, individual level it is that we model the act of caring for one another. And I am encouraged. I am encouraged that this sanctuary is pretty much full this morning, that there are people in this community who care for others, that there are people willing to work. No matter how small we chisel away at these systems of oppression, we are willing to take those steps. We have a history of offering this kind of radical, oppressive, system-thwarting care going all the way back to people like Dorothea Dix. One thing I always think of is this 19-year-old who came to the HIV testing center. And he was HIV negative, and he came the next week for another test, smiling sheepishly. And so I told him, I said, you know, it's too soon for another test. But he didn't get up to leave. It was the talking he was there for, not the test. We talked about the schoolwork he tried to complete while riding the bus from the one job to the other that he worked at to support his unemployed mother. Do you have anyone in your life you can talk to? I asked. He shook his head. There's nobody. An elderly man told me that he came to get tested for the fellowship. Surely we can do better than that, right? Surely we can create a world where people don't have to go get tested for a virus in order to find fellowship. We have people like Dorothea Dix paving the way. Many of us in the sanctuary, I would suggest all of us, have felt the ache of loneliness at one point or another. We have this community, and we can imagine what it feels like to not have anything, to feel as though you don't have anything, no one on your side. The work at the HIV testing center began to lift those chains of loneliness, just like Dorothea Dix took away those chains from those mentally ill prisoners in those basements. And I know some of you have seen that work in your own lives and things that this church has done. And yet so much work remains, folks. And I think at this moment in time, I think we are being called to do this work in a way that some of us have never experienced in our lifetime. There are reasons why women who have been historically marginalized and struggled with powerlessness are the worldwide fastest growing group of HIV infections. There are reasons why young black men are the fastest growing group of HIV infections in the United States. And this is just HIV I'm focusing on. We can see these kinds of patterns in other diseases and medical issues that target those who are marginalized. There's a system at work here, folks, and it's not pretty. It requires continued health reform. It requires the dismantling of systematic oppressive systems. It requires safe places for people to heal, to grow, to learn to truly love and be loved, perhaps for the first time. And there is hope. We Unitarian Universalists have a history of working to connect society to people the system tried to throw out. We can name, women's rights, racial equality, helping to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. This is the challenge of connection in a world where forces are pushing us to alienate ourselves from one another. Dorothea Dix said, in a world where there is so much to be done, I feel strongly impressed. There must be something for me to do. Isn't there something for us to do? I think of the people that left the HIV testing center empowered to make better choices just from feeling momentarily cared for. How many people are out there waiting for the invitation to life that we could offer as Unitarian Universalists, as caring human beings? There are countless other ways we can connect people together. Countless ways we can work to eradicate that poverty of loneliness and disconnection that leads to so many of the world's great problems. Not just AIDS and other diseases, not just healthcare concerns, but also famine and war and human trafficking and on and on and on. All rooted, I believe, in that same sense of alienation that plagues today's world. Alienation that has been exacerbated by the recent discourse we have heard during the past election. Rhetoric that further dehumanizes Muslims, women, immigrants, and those who identify as BLGTQ. And many of those people are frightened. Frightened by the people our president-elect is choosing to put into power. People who have a history of making policies and supporting rhetoric that can be seen as undermining the worth and dignity of some of those identity groups. Like the person who's been named senior counselor and who has a history of supporting a white supremacist group. These are challenging times we live in, my friends, and change starts here. And I suggest you start today with something maybe very simple, that first step you take this afternoon, a phone call to a lonely and anxious friend struggling with their fears about our future, or as ambitiously as building a hands-on outreach organization dedicated to protecting the rights of those who are now in sudden danger of being deported. We Unitarian Universalists have been the voice of justice throughout our history, and we are called to be so again. We can do it. I will say I stand up here grateful to be here today. Not just here, but just to be here at all. The truth is that most of the young gay men I came of age with, those who I called friends, are actually not here anymore. They had such promise, such strength, but there were forces at work that made it tough for them to go on. Just as those forces continue to make it tough for so many people throughout the world because of their gender, sexual orientation, race, socioeconomic class, and on and on. We can be grateful to be part of Unitarian Universalism, which calls us to actively create a better world for those going forward, to continue the legacy of Dorothea Dix, to offer the healing power of connection as we work to snuff out the forces that keep people from living out their inherent potential. I believe in us. I wouldn't be here if I didn't. I believe in us, I believe in those who support the work of this church community, who know that by supporting this community, we are supporting the wider work of Unitarian Universalism, that we won't stop until there is a world free of oppression where people are cared for, nurtured, and allowed to live out their full potential. It is this idea we see when we all come together. And it's not just a fantasy. It will take hard work. It will likely never be perfect. It will never likely be seen in our lifetimes. But transformation is attainable. And it starts here and now in this moment. We are being called. Let us answer that call.